Andy, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking time out your schedule. I'm super pumped for this episode. Get to talk about all things contact, grappling, and rugby. And I haven't had the chance to do that for a while, being over here in the US. So yeah, really pumped. Why don't, before we just get into a few things, why don't you just introduce yourself to the listeners, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, first off, appreciate you having me on. Huge fan, been following your work for a while, so it's awesome to be able to talk some shop. And again, huge rugby fan myself, so it's always good when I get a chance to talk with another coach or another fan about that sport over here. So my background is I'm the senior manager of education and training at USA Football, where the sport's national governing body. Because of the setup of the NFL and the NCAA being a monstrous structure with overseeing sport, we work primarily with youth and high school. So even though NCAA is amateur, we technically deal mostly with the younger ages. I have a coaching background, former collegiate coach in football. Also did some strength and conditioning work within the rugby community because my studies were in movement science. I actually had wanted to be a strength coach all through college and kind of fell into sport coaching because my coaches thought I had a knack for understanding the game. But I was a dual code player in college, played American football and rugby. I went to Penn State University. So played both sports, coached in both sports, was lucky enough to spend 3 years with the U.S. national team as a rugby player, was probably maybe physically better suited for that game. Not quite as explosive as an NFL football player, but had fairly good conditioning compared, especially to my football mates. And my father had been a rugby coach. My brothers all played rugby. They were all Americans, U19 players for the U.S. So had a family tradition there. So it wasn't like this crazy swap out. And so a couple years ago when rugby tackling, kind of the concussion stuff was in full swing, I really lucked into it because I had a unique background of having been involved in both sports and maybe could help translate some information back and forth and share some best practices. And now I work primarily in the contact aspect of football. So at the higher levels, focusing really on tackling, prep for contact, getting athletes prepared for the collision and contact aspects. And then as we go down the levels, it's, we start working on game types, coaching education, coaching cues, but hoping to support the coaches that are out there in the field. That's really my role.
That's awesome. Yeah, like such an interesting kind of journey as well, because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but a dual sport athlete in like a D1 school like Penn State is not, that's not a common thing, is it?
No, if I didn't have the family ties, it probably wouldn't be as big of a thing. Now, the great story for everyone who's been in the collegiate system, and we know how coaches can be. So my freshman year, I asked if I could play rugby in the spring, and the coaches said no. Like you need a great spring practice, being a part of the program, like kind of earn and cement your spot. And I thought, fair enough, so I'll take it. So I stayed and trained, worked really hard, and thought things went well. And then my second year, I came back and said, hey, I'd really love to give rugby a go this spring. And I got the, hey, you're a really valuable member of the team. We can't afford an injury. So it wasn't until later in my career and post football, but I had, the extra season and year remaining that I was able to really dive in deep into rugby. But so I played for Penn State in rugby, was lucky enough to make Collegiate All-American, which is kind of what exposed me to the national team staff and got me in that setup. But again, my journey was different because I had grown up on the side of a rugby pitch. My father was a coach, head coach for 11 years. So like I'm in a backpack before I could walk, with mom going to games. So it wasn't something that was just like, hey, I've seen that on ESPN or some random highlight. Let me give it a whirl. I always knew I had the itch, but rugby wasn't as popular, obviously early. So there wasn't like a youth program. My high school team didn't start until like 4 years after I graduated. So now they have a program, but I had to wait till college. And then I had to wait till I got the coach's blessing before I was able to dive in. But I did know the rules. I was a fan. We're watching the games on DVR, working with my dad being a coach. We're following the World Cups. And so I had probably a leg up on making the transition because I understood the game fairly well.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something with like with the US system. It's obviously rugby seems to slowly but surely kind of trickling into the colleges and things like that as well. Whereas it's obviously well cemented, obviously, in kind of the UK sport in kind of culture. You've got essentially football, so soccer, and you've got rugby for the main two sports over there. And it's slowly kind of filtering over here. And you've got some big names coming from European rugby now to play in the in Major League Rugby. I think it is slowly getting there. And I think America at some point, might be 10 years down the line, will eventually become a powerhouse in rugby if they get it right, because there is some crazy good athletes there as well that have got the foundation in those kind of alactic high-end outputs that you need to be a good rugby player. They just don't have the underpinning qualities to be able to repeat that all too often.
Yeah, and obviously the skills and decision-making are typically what the American team gets pinged on just because you don't grow up playing it. The benefit, I would think, in the future is we have such a huge population that even with kind of the big four sports, that there's a potential to have enough athletes that you get some quality athletes going over to rugby and starting to play earlier. And I think with such a huge population, people are looking for their spot. And I love football. I mean, I still love both codes deeply. I work in both codes, but different people are going to be attracted to different sports. And so, you know, whether you're a basketball player who wants more contact and you like the idea of this open running game of rugby that's free flowing and involves decision making and passing, maybe that feels like basketball to you because of, like you said, that free flow decision making style, but you crave some contact, so you may transfer. Maybe you're a football player who, like to your point, doesn't quite have the alactic power that's needed, but you know you can go for days, and maybe you're not 300 pounds, but you're 250 pounds. So instead of becoming an NFL guard, you might make a great international level front row forward because you're maybe a little bit shorter and not quite heavy enough. And so people will slowly start seeing where those opportunities. Obviously, the U.S. rise in sevens, probably due to the world or to the Olympics and the influx of money and resources. So I'm really hopeful for the new MLR. And if that can get up and off the ground, what does that bring? The resources and the structure to help develop the players similar to what's happened in sevens.
Yeah, 100%. And now earlier you mentioned concussion. Now it's obviously been a big issue in the NFL and in Premier League rugby over in the UK and just, well, world rugby. It's on high on their agenda to cut down the amount of concussions due to mainly they're trying to limit tackle height, taking it from kind of shoulders down, even down to nipple height to a degree they've been trialing.
Yep.
So, and I know there's experts from kind of UK rugby being over to the US to demonstrate tackling technique and things like that. And I know you talk around tackling technique quite a lot yourself, but how much of an influence can tackle technique have on concussion, first and foremost? But then secondly, how is that going to look as part of a return to play structure, bearing in mind our current climate with essentially we're not doing anything, there's no tackling or anything going on at the moment. How does that return to play process look to getting back to kind of full contact?
Yeah, so there's a, both of our sports or both of the sports, shall we say, are facing similar challenges. And that's going to happen in collision sports, especially as maybe winning the collision became such the emphasis for a period of time. In both sports, we can probably track back that it just became about winning that collision. And so the things that I think are sometimes there were improper technical models being taught. So like for the sake of winning the collision, we may have been teaching things that weren't in hindsight the best thing to teach. And maybe we didn't have the information, maybe the science was still growing. And so we were, I come from a generation in football where we were taught to tackle with our face. And the reason being was if you tackled with your face, your head would be up and you'd protect your neck. So if I tackled with my nose, my neck would always be in a solid position. And conveniently, we have this big plastic shell and a face mask, so you're not going to bust your nose. Obviously, you wouldn't do that in rugby. That's not going to go well for your lips and your eyes and your broken nose. But that's how we were taught. And I just think people didn't have the information. Now, as we've continued to gather data, as the research is upended, we've moved away from those technical models that using your helmet as a primary contact point, and yes, your face mask is part of your helmet, and that's attached to your face, is attached to your head, so we all got to keep it in perspective. We've moved away from those technical models. So now we get into proper technical model teaching, which has huge, huge impacts. I think my guess would be in rugby, what happened was the rise of the choke tackle and tackling the ball in an effort to slow down recycling and slow down the defense slowly crept the height of the tackle up. And what we have to remember in both cases is the athletes that are playing these games are incredible athletes. So as we start to raise our tackle heights and as we start to worry about winning the collision, and maybe we're teaching tackle with your nose, any dip in accuracy can start to result in collisions that have negative outcomes. And so we have to worry about that, look at that and decide, one, are our technical models good enough? Are the technical models putting people in the right positions? Are we training it appropriately, which is a whole nother area? And then how can we adjust the rules, the technical model, or the aim points to help put our athletes in the best situations? So I came to accuracy, and I think that's probably the key within both sports, is that we can say with everything we know about the, you know, what we've learned from injury and this and that, our players need to be incredibly accurate, right? We have to be able to put our head, our shoulders, our body shapes, our spinal positions, like we have to get those things right. And so to me, that comes to one, are our technical models really good? And are we training it effectively to be able to execute it on game day? So a lot of our drills are really overly structured because we want to get the model right. In an effort to keep our players healthy, you know, we'll use a lot of training aids, which is, I believe they call them over across the pond. You know, we use bags and shields here in the American football thing, but we're training on those surfaces to preserve the number of impacts and the health of our players. And so you get into that strange dichotomy where, are we providing a realistic enough, chaotic enough stimulus that's going to help game day accuracy in this highly variable manner when we need it, if all we're doing is training versus a stationary, soft, shielded padding? So I think we have to be really critical in how we look at, are our athletes being trained to handle the stress, speed, and dynamicism of game day to maintain their accuracy, to put their shoulders and heads where they want and execute a proper tackle so that the technical model stays true. How that affects us right now is a great question, and one that I've been doing a lot of work in recently, because for our collegiate football programs, we've missed spring practice, which is a huge focus on skill training for most teams. A huge focus on fundamentals, techniques, getting that stuff right. So we're building into our preseason and installing our offense and defense. As we've seen with the NFL, they're going to virtual offseason training, which looks like we'll install a lot of our playbook. We'll have our systems in. Everyone will know exactly what to do, but it seems pretty common sense to me. And again, my opinion here, but if the season ends, you know, in January and February, and we start again on time, so we'll say, you know, in April into September, we've gone a huge block of months without working on our absolute core skills. And this is where I think football and rugby differ from some of our other sports. So you mentioned you work in tennis. Like, if your ground strokes are your core skill, you cannot always go work on that. I mean, you can go hit against the wall. There's great drills, soccer players, basketball players. We can always go shoot and pass and work on our core skills. Mm-hmm. The contact skills, blocking, tackling, rucking and tackling, those become very difficult to work on in the off season. And so what I believe is when we have these big layoffs, our technical accuracy will take a dip just because you can't not do something for 4, 5, 6 months and expect to come back at the same level of accuracy and precision. So when we do get back into our collision work, have our athletes had a progressive buildup, a runway that's going to allow them to rebuild their technical accuracy before we expose them to intensity. And I think that's something coaches are going to have to manage incredibly well so that we make sure our athletes are buttoned up and sharp by the time we expose them to the intensity of practice and game speed collisions so that they can handle them in the appropriate manner. Those who rush because they feel like they need to make up the time, I think the technical accuracy will put athletes maybe in poor body positions, or their shoulders won't go exactly where they want to. You know, spatial awareness is just a little bit off because haven't done it in a while, and poor technique and poor execution can obviously put us in an increased injury risk because we're now in these awkward or body positions that aren't kind of ideal.
So, and would you, with that in mind, would you almost strip it back to, obviously we don't want to go back and go like full pads, for example, but would you strip it back like day one, it's like, okay, we're just doing some basic like crawling patterns and stuff like that, just to start getting that extra stress on the tissues of like the shoulder and knee and hip and everything like that, and then introduce it to grappling and then go to some sort of like contact? Is that the way you'd potentially look at the progression?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in what we call our prep for contact materials. I think you've heard me talk about this before, but our crawling and our grappling, they offer a couple things. And actually, I'll pull up a slide here for us. But so when we talk about getting to contact, we have to look at all the things that are involved. And so this is from a presentation I've done earlier. But so when we talk about the tackle skills, and this could be looked at rugby, right? We have to look at, there's distinct physical qualities that underpin contact collision skills, and it's more than just strength and power, right? And so we have to have that spatial awareness, that kinesthetic awareness, that ability to put our body where we want to. So in rugby, for instance, you mentioned they're bringing the tackle, they brought the tackle line down kind of from the shoulder to the nipple in those trial heights. And that's well and good. But the coaches and even the administrators have to be able to ask, if we say to move your shoulder down and target lower, do our athletes have the physical ability to put their body where they want to in space? And so I talk with college football coaches quite a bit on the penalty avoidance, you know, and the helmet to helmet or shoulder to helmet contact. And you can give all the coaching cues you want. If your athletes can't effectively put their shoulder where they want to in space, your coaching cues are meaningless. So we have to make sure we handle that. I think there's some conceptual learnings about force, postures, shapes that we really learn through grappling, how to position our hips and spine to deliver power, flow with power, brace for power that we need. Obviously the effects of combatives on fatigue. So a lot of our athletes are at home doing, hopefully doing their running programs. And so they come back and they have some good running fitness, but those combatives are a different kind of fatigue. And obviously we know, from some of the research, I believe Dr. Sharif Hendricks out of South Africa, the effects of fatigue on tackle accuracy. So as players fatigue, as we, you know, our postures break down, our abilities to hold shapes break down, there can be some negative outcomes there. And I always use the term grapple drills because we don't want to make them specific to rugby or football. Why I like kind of hiding it, we'll say, in that grapple drill is it may also allow our S&C coaches or our physical prep coaches to do some of this work, because we're not actually trying to teach the tackle or the breakdown or the jackal. We're trying to build the general qualities that support that, because I think it's really important that we start to build those up before the first day of camp and the first day of trying to execute that skill in a practice kind of modified game situation. So we want to build some of those things up. And some of the things I really like that I think we develop through crawling, tumbling, grappling would be some of these physical qualities. So obviously static and dynamic balance in these awkward positions where we're being pushed and pulled and our feet aren't quite set and our, you know, our spinal angles aren't right 100% perfect. Postural awareness. So when is my when am I in good posture? When am I in poor posture? And how do I get back to it? General body awareness and body control. It's a great global strengthening exercise. And we all know this. We've talked about this. Some of that global strength is kind of that farm boy strength where it's like I can lay on a bench press and be completely supported and completely stable and have huge outputs with my pressing. But on the field, I need this global strength, this bracing, this lower body kind of root my cleats into the ground, squeeze my posture down so that I can execute that pressing force without changing my own spinal shape or without changing my own feet. So I need that kind of global strength. And whether it's a farmer or a wrestler who you outweigh by 50 pounds and you lock up with them, you're like, holy cow, like, how is this person doing that? That ability to apply force on the field is really important. Obviously, there's great core strength.
Just before you go on there, because that's something that we talked a little bit off camera about. That's something that I massively had growing up, and maybe some people, especially the younger athletes, maybe going to college and things like that, there's something for them to think about, because I wasn't like a fanboy growing up or anything like that. I had to get my physicality, for lack of a better word, from the weight room. I had to develop physically in the weight room. Whereas a lot of these farm boys, they've obviously been throwing hay bales around and working on the farm like 12 hours a day or whatever it may be, developing this, would I be right in calling it special strength? Is that kind of the right word there? Or is it literally just farmer strength? Because when I've been playing against these guys, more often than not, especially when I was younger, they were the best guys on the field. If they're over a ruck, and they're kind of clamping onto a ball. They're in this awkward, rounded back position, looking a bit like Quasimodo, just latched onto this ball, and you cannot move them for love or money. Now, if you've got other guys in there that have maybe been taught, like we talked about off camera, to keep that flat back RDL position, like you're not going to be able to maintain that flat back RDL position reaching over for a ball in a ruck. Now, is that where, obviously, like what you're talking about there, is that the special strength training? Is just being a farmer mean you're like you've got special strength, or how does that work?
Yeah, so we use the term special strength because I think it's just the most easily understood kind of applicable term. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, I don't know, but I think coaches understand that. But the ability to display your strength in this huge variety of modified positions and really versus dynamic 360 degree forces is something that is kind of learned through these experiences. And that experience could be baling hay and building a fence and shearing sheep. I'm sure every athlete, right, has a story, whether it's, you know, the rugby players who said the farm boys when you're younger, college football teams, you come in and there's a guy from a farm community or maybe from kind of like a construction background, and in the weight room their numbers are completely pedestrian, and on the field they get their hands on you and you're like, oh my goodness, like what is this all about? And so I think there's a bit of global strength which comes to some of the challenges. Like, so we'll use a squat for example. When you're going to squat, like athletes spend 10, 15 seconds sometimes getting in the perfect setup to be able to demonstrate maximum output. Well, on the field, we don't have that. So when I have to snap into position in milliseconds because I'm reading a play and there's a threat now coming at me and I'm going to be in awkward different positions, can I still express those forces? And I love my strength training, don't get me wrong. But I think we also know that increased output in the weight room is not guaranteed to transfer to increased output on the field. We kind of have to learn to display that new strength. So maybe we do have a great off season and we increase our maximum output, but we still got to learn how to display that. And I think Grappling kind of helps build that bridge of how, where we learn how to use it integrated with our whole body and how to brace and flow and execute it on awkward body positions and rounded backs, or maybe I'm rotated, my spine isn't completely straight. You know, you mentioned the rounded back in a jackal or a poach position, whatever you call it. Like, that's, you see that every rugby game the world over. No coach is teaching their RDL or deadlift like that. But those are, but so if all of your work is in that perfect safety position, now we go on the field, we kind of got to grapple and fight it out and learn to adjust your feet and the hip height and how do I like to be, where do I feel comfortable? And then you can kind of lock down and show that strength. So I think that's massively important. You know, in a lot of ways, I think what some of what we're doing in physical development now is actually recreating some of the learning environments from when we were younger, where we talk about, say, sports specialization. So now our programs are becoming really general because maybe we're recreating some of the movement exploration or the variety of movement exposure that a specialist athlete in tennis doesn't have anymore, because maybe there's no PE in schools, there's cut down in recess and kind of all that kind of stuff. So we're recreating those things. If we're not out roughhousing and playing pickup games in the neighborhood with the kids like we used to, well, now we're recreating some of these grappling scenarios and these roughhousing scenarios to help our athletes learn these skills, kind of connect those dots. Maybe there's some neurological connections. Maybe there's just some conceptual learning about positioning and threats and opportunities that we can use to now apply with our technical skills. But I think going back to the core metric, it is a vital bridge between weight room exercises and sport-specific skill that we learn to express those strengths versus another human being that's resisting and fighting. And oh, by the way, is trained to not let you win, mind you. So if we're talking professional rugby or NCAA football, like the guy you're trying to move is trained to not move. So we're going to have to really express those things in a unique manner. And it's going to take a ton of adaptation. And so how do we learn how to do that? Well, I think that's the vital bridge, is we learn how to use our forces to effectively move someone. And then your sport coach gives you a singular or multi techniques, which I call sharpening the sword. So I have a conceptual learning of how my body works. If my hips are close to you, if my hips are far away, if my spine is rounded, if my spine is flat, if I have underhooks, if I'm inside, like just general learnings that hopefully a strength coach can be able to do, because it's just grappling. I'm not teaching you to block or tackle. I'm not teaching you to tackle or clean out the ruck or how to poach. I'm teaching you how to control your body versus an external stimulus. Now your sport coach sharpens that sword by giving you some specific techniques. And now when you try to apply that technique and you feel pressure or you feel an opportunity or a threat from your opponent, those conceptual learnings might have built a mental model and some pattern recognition that you say, oh, I better brace, I better push back, I better sink my hips. And it's all one big intertwined learning experience. So I hope that made sense.
Yeah, for sure. And that was actually kind of jumped onto what my next question was, which was almost about addressing like the elephant in the room, for the lack of a better word, in terms of kind of, is contact the sport skill? And I know you definitely touched on it then. And is it the S&C coach's job? And I think you pretty much answered that in terms of saying we're prepping them. It's not the sports skill. It's not teaching them to block or whatever it is. It's giving them those underlying foundational qualities to bridge that gap to the skill. Is that right?
Yeah. So I think, like you said, the way I look at it is there's physical qualities, right? The ability to brace, the ability to balance, the ability to exert force in both positive and maybe negative body positions. A term we really like is reshaping. So the ability to, inside of a contact situation, move from a poor posture to a quality posture so that I can effectively exert my force against you. The conceptual learnings, like we said, of kind of our spatial awareness, our body position, our threats, our opportunities. Maybe I'm a long, lanky guy and I learn what I can do with my arms, and that, you know, regardless of your thoughts against it, if I'm a lighter guy with really long arms, maybe getting in and around people in gator rolling or judo rolling is going to be a great technique for me, because I can kind of tie people up and get around their body and get a good solid lock. If I'm a short, stubby armed athlete, but I'm low and compact, I'm probably going to, you know, get under someone and try to traditionally drive them off. Well, we learn this about how we move in these combative situations. And so I think it's huge. The other thing that I've said before, and I'll say again, is contact and collision is a physiological stimulus, right? We understand that there can be some breakdown. There's blood markers of fatigue that occur within the body when we have high collision practice days. It is a physiological stimulus. So it once we remove the idea of specified sport technique and think of collision contact as a physiological stimulus, then maybe we can reframe it as, is this a stimulus similar to sprinting, similar to change of direction, that we need to prepare our athletes for, so that when they go into preseason camp, they've built up some sort of resiliency, some sort of work tolerance to what's going to occur. Now, we're not going to try to absolutely mimic the collision intensity, magnitude, force, or specificity of delivery, i.e. technique, that'll happen on the practice field, but I can surely build a bridge that makes, what I don't want to do is go from zero to first week of training camp load, right? That's a huge jump. I mean, we wouldn't, hopefully, we're having good conversations in cross-departmental performance groups that are running volumes, are running loads, are high-speed sprint loads. We're not going from zero the last week of training block into 100 the first week of preseason. Yet traditionally, that's what we've done with contact. We've gone from, hey, we're lifting weights, we're running, we're lifting weights, we're running. Now, first week of preseason, we're put to this contact load, and there's absolutely no bridge, no buildup, no workload tolerance. The reason why, again, I've listed here and I'll put it up again here, we use the term grappling because we're trying to keep it general. I want it to be an umbrella term. I know here in the States, right, freestyle, folk style, Olympic style, Greco-Roman wrestling all have huge backgrounds. Those aren't maybe as popular in the Commonwealth countries, but you do see BJJ, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and Judo, and there are some other forms that are maybe more popular. But I can steal some general stuff from any one of those sports, so we're just going to call it grappling. We're not trying to create skilled grapplers, which is really important. And so here in the States, it's really easy to go find a wrestling coach, right? They're at every high school, they're at every college, but I don't need to understand the total technical detail because I'm not trying to create a skilled grappler. I'm trying to expose them to the physiological stimulus and the learning environment that grappling exposes them to. And then I can keep it sport and skill agnostic when I'm focusing on, like I said, controlling another human being, modifying postures, push, pull, brace kind of games and activities that keep us out of the sport specific realm. So as a S&C or prep coach, I'm not trying to teach you how to block. I'm trying to teach you how to manage your posture and exert force on another human being who's trying to do the same thing to you. I'm to keep it general in nature because we don't want our sport coaches, right, to think like we're trying to step on their toes or trying to teach the skills. We're going to keep it hugely general just to build up the tolerance. And where I think we can get a win with sport coaches is when we say, what I'm going to do is hopefully build an athlete that has some robustness and some workload tolerance to these combative situations. What that's going to allow you to do is get more high quality training, because when you start to train in combative situations to work on your technique, we'll say, of offensive line and hand placement, those guys aren't going to get smoked on day one, and by day two and day three, they fall apart. If that resiliency allows them to manage the workload, you're going to get more high quality training because the players aren't going to be injured, worn down, beat up. They'll ultimately become better better at their sport because they're able to accumulate the specific training volumes that they need. I think if you go from 0 to 100, players break down, you lose quality training, and it can actually hurt their technical development.
And do you think that that's sometimes where there's a little bit of a disconnect when coaches just bring in a judo coach, for example, and they maybe don't have the same understanding of kind of how that system fits in place in terms of grappling compared to what you do? And it's because I've been in numerous clubs back home where it's like, oh, we've got the judo guy and he's going to teach us how to do these roles and stuff like that. And it's, I really struggle to understand how that kind of affected kind of my performance. Obviously getting over a ruck and things and having that role is useful, but I think it's more of, like you say, understanding the physiological processes behind it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on. So I think it takes, are there things you can learn from these other sports? Obviously 100%, but the specific application is very sport specific. I mean, my mentor, Richie Gray, who a tackle kind of guru world over, works with USA football, works with world rugby, multiple professional international teams, talks about, he worked with the Miami Dolphins in between gigs with South Africa and Scotland, right? Tough life he lives. So, but he was talking about that, you know, like the games are completely different and we have to understand those differences. So the biggest difference in football and rugby is there's a blocker. So like rugby, it's a lot easier to talk about like your shapes and postures going into the collision, because by law, you're allowed free access to the ball carrier. Now they're going to try to confuse you with misdirection, but there's not a 300-pound man who gets paid $15 million a year blocking you and keeping you from getting to the ball. Now in football, my path to the ball carrier is going to be obstructed and my posture is probably going to get manipulated and I'm going to get all out of whack and jacked up because this guy is, I have to defeat the block first. So are there techniques we can steal and use from each other? Absolutely. But we better respect the differences. And I think that's what has happened sometimes with grappling stuff, is that we don't respect the differences. And so it can never be a blanket copy and paste. It's about, okay, well, what can we learn from them? What's applicable? What works? And more importantly, what doesn't work? And then a good coach, I think, is going to look at that kind of reverse engineering needs analysis and say, hey, this drill from sport X actually would be great for sport Y because we're going to get some anti-rotational and rotational power in and amongst a moving, restricted opponent. Like, let's do this little body lock grapple drill for general means because it's going to be different. And so if we can break down these exercises and activities, see what we're getting from a physical standpoint, and we think that that carries over to our sport, and then we can use them. Where coaches get nervous is, are we building bad habits? Like, because, oh, we're doing this drill and we're grabbing, we're holding, we're lifting. I don't teach my athletes to move their feet this way, but general means are general means. We have sport practice for a reason, which is to sharpen and focus the general abilities that we've created. But so I think that's, it's absolutely huge that, yeah, would I love to have a high level judo practitioner come and do some stuff with me? And I'm going to take pages and pages and pages of notes. But what actually makes the program could be very limited based on the sport that I'm applying it to. And we have to have the confidence to say, no matter how good this is, it doesn't fit my environment or the context of this sport.
Yeah. And I think understanding that is obviously key. And that's in the past when, like I said earlier, when I've had guys coming in and trying to teach me, I'm just like, I don't see how this is like fully applicable. You can, like you say, you make a few pages of notes and you maybe action one or two of those key points, and then you move on and take what's good and kind of get rid of what's not so useful and build a program based around those points. Just moving on slightly, what would you say to coaches who maybe aren't necessarily in the football or rugby world and maybe aren't convinced that they're just like, oh, coach, like, look, we're a non-contact sport, or like my tennis players, for example, they hate any sort of contact, you know, like, you know, that what the tennis players like, you can imagine they don't necessarily like jumping on each other, given, even if it's like a a farmer's carrier or something like that, you know, like stuff that we used to do growing up playing rugby. That was part of our almost like strength training on the field. What would you say to coaches who aren't convinced, when particularly in terms of, it's a twofold question here. Can you use it as a, I'm going to kind of point you in two directions, hopefully. I don't want to confuse you too much, but can you use it as a prehab or rehab for your athletes, particularly maybe like tennis athletes, for example, the overhead athlete? Is grappling useful there? And then on the second part of the question is, can you develop that into other sports, and how would you use that?
Yeah, so my short answer is yes. And I'll go back to this slide you put up earlier, and that's, is there any athlete that we don't think would benefit from some of these physical abilities that are up on the screen, right? So body awareness, body control, like at what point does the simple unweighted control your own body weight? Yes, that's where we want to start, no doubt, right? But with high-level athletes, a collegiate athlete who has aspirations of winning a league championship in tennis, right? Like, at what point does body weight, body control, and body awareness kind of start to become a the return on investment isn't as great, and we need to start putting external stimuluses on there to challenge their current abilities and get them to really stretch their ability to find themselves in space, right? So I think that when we think about these crawling drills, which I'm a huge fan of, and the grappling drills, again, we pull it down and it's break it apart and go, it's not about grappling. It's a general means. And I think these are some of the general means that we get out of grappling drills. And if you were to take this list to a coach and say like that, hey, I'm going to use a kettlebell, and we think we're going to get these qualities out of it, they're going to go, great, use a kettlebell. Now we go, actually, I'm sorry, wrong list. We're going to get these out of grappling. And they're going, no, can't do it. Wait, but it's the same adaptations. You said you wanted those adaptations, but the delivery mechanism somehow scared you away. And I think that's the environment we all have ourselves working in.
That's exactly what I've experienced it in terms of, okay, let's maybe do a little bit of like crawling or whatever it is. And then, like you say, coach doesn't think that's maybe as safe for the shoulders of the athlete or whatever it is. And it's just a means that you deliver it. But the kettlebell is fine, but then we can't get into this kind of all fours position and just march up and down the court. It's because you think that the athlete's going to get injured. It blows my mind.
it's amazing. And I think it goes to show our preconceived notion about the delivery mechanism, right? So that like if I were to say this list is from, I don't know, sandbag training or kettlebell training, and I just pick those because those are in a lot of weight rooms, right? So a sport coach might not think twice if they saw an athlete in the weight room tossing a sandbag around. But as soon as it becomes grapple, it's all, my guys are going to get injured, and we're going to, no way, that's not sport specific. And so delivery mechanism becomes the shade, the kind of eyewash that can confuse us. So it's difficult, obviously, the communication means, but to break down, here's what we're getting out of it. The other thing that I really like is you can make these games really fun activities. This is what we do with our youth kids, right? So for our youth athletes who are just learning contact skills, we want to introduce them to friction and personal space and all that battle kind of culture stuff, right? Well, if you've never roughhoused, if you don't have siblings, if it's your first year playing, those are new experiences. So we're going to create games and activities. We're actually going to put it in a fun environment that you're like, you know, capture the cone and win the line or whatever we're going to do. But we're in these battles, we're recreating these frictions, and you're just trying to like beat your buddy in a little competition. And so I do think the delivery mechanism of the coach, like if you were to go into your tennis player, maybe we'll say, and like try to install a grappling drill with the mindset of like, you need to learn to dominate your opponent physically on the football field and move an athlete against his will. Like he stereotypically, maybe they're not as receptive. But if you create these as fun challenges amongst teammates, where it's like, we're going to use some some grappling and some control games where one player is trying to get across the line or, I don't know, capture the cone or something, and you're allowed to use some grapple mechanics to keep them from getting away. Now we're getting these push, pull, grab, move, fighting for underhooks and hip positions and leaning and pushing. But it's all about, hey, I got the cone, or I got across the line. It comes across very differently. So delivery mechanism does I think count. Fun. I always say, like, we want to make games and activities as opposed to drills when we're worried about buy-in. It's just kind of my hack. It's just how we frame it. So that can do wonders. And then to your point with the shoulder girdle mobility, flexibility, strength stuff, as far as prehab, rehab, I mean, I am a huge fan of crawling. One, you get the body awareness, spatial awareness, coordination, cross crawl patterning, all that kind of stuff. But I think you're able to load the shoulder in a way that's unique. And when you're crawling, or when we're doing some of our moves, and I'll pull up some of our simple moves here, but what you actually get is the hand is fixed and the body starts to rotate around the fixed hand and the fixed arm. So now your shoulder is what's moving through this range of motion. And I love this kind of closed chain. I'm going to fix my hand and rotate my body around it. And the load of someone's body weight is much more generally than we're able to expose the athlete to with, like, our typical elastic band kind of arm care, rotator cuff work. So I don't even know what this drill is, but I'll just... So I'm just, oh, that's a neat, so there's a little more hip action on that one, but you just kind of see how my shoulders are working through these ranges. Reach through. So, but as you see, my shoulder, right, goes through this huge range of loaded motion. And so I think that's for every athlete, right? That I'm going to work through a huge range of motion. I think this is a good point. So I'm doing, right, a sit through to a one arm kind of bridge. You look at the range of motion under load, my shoulder joint, shoulder capsule, all that is exposed to. And through these ranges of motion under load, well, now I have a really strong shoulder complex. For me, I think a lot of safety and shoulder health is the integrated shoulder complex, right? There's nothing wrong with isolating the rotator cuffs or the subscap and trying to strengthen those. But at the end of the day, if my entire shoulder girdle isn't working together to stabilize and hold and generate force or manage force, like, it's not going to work to the best of our ability, right? As I say in contact sport, when I run into a 300-pound man at full speed, my isolated rotator cuff extension isn't what's keeping me glued together. The fact that I can use my trap, my upper chest, my bicep tendon, my delt, like all those things working together to lock me down and keep me centrated and keep me together, very, very useful, right? So these fun exercises, I think, start to build tons of strength, and also they hit unique angles. I'll steal the line from Vernon Griffith, right? Explore the corners. We start getting into some corners and some angles that we might not be able to get to in our traditional exercises. I haven't used it just because, I'll be honest, I wasn't exposed to a lot of kettlebell training. I'm a little bit older, but some guys I value their opinion of, like, you know, working on the kettlebell arm bar series and kind of the same concept of driving load through the joint and controlling through a range. I think that's incredibly important. Now, I could have my athlete do a kettlebell arm bar series, right? And the coach would probably be comfortable with that because it looks like a traditional weight room exercise. But if I have my soccer or field hockey or tennis athletes doing some of these crazy crawl movements, it just looks a little funky. And so there's that resistance. But at the end of the day, we go, look at what we're doing to the shoulder joint. And isn't that really important to keep that stabilized? it's easier said than done, but I think that's the message we're trying to pass along.
For sure. And I really like that as well. It's looking at, like, realistically, how much is a cable external rotation? You're very much isolating a very small muscle group there. Whereas if we look at it from more of a global standpoint instead of a local standpoint, let's actually involve like the traps, the rhomboids, even the lats, delts, everything.
100%.
Like you said, this realistically, as well as the smaller muscles, that's everything's the glue that hold it together. It's how you interact between the head of the humerus and like the glenoid fossa and everything else, and that shoulder blade kind of tying into the whole system. And I think it's a great way to explore it.
I think I've heard Eric Cressy, obviously baseball kind of guru guy, talk about like all of your lat work, both your mobility and your strength work, but all of your lat work is arm care. That like arm care doesn't have to be just your rotations and your subscap and all that kind of stuff. Like your lat plays a huge role in decelerating that overhead movement. And so I kind of like that. I've never worked in baseball. I've never worked with quarterbacks, so I have no throwing athlete experience, but the concept makes sense. And I think we can apply it to these other situations that integrated nature is so valuable.
Definitely. Definitely. And then another question there, just kind of leading away slightly from some of the, like the floor based movements, is how do you develop that into like soccer, basketball, things like that, where we maybe, obviously we need like a strong shoulder complex and things like that, but you talked about earlier kind of winning the hip battle. Can you just go into some details and what you mean by that?
Yeah. So one of kind of my thoughts is when we're doing a sport evaluation, we're going to look at all the contact situations. And one of the things that I always want to look at, and I use big, cool words because I'm a football rugby guy and it sounds awesome, but what are the weapons we're allowed to use, right? So in football, I can punch you in the chest with my hands. And in football and rugby, I'm going to dynamically explode right into contact with the front of my shoulder. We'll say something like soccer or basketball even. We start to use the lateral edge of our shoulder. You know, we're kind of pushing more laterally. We're not kind of that straight on punch. So instead of using our hands and forearms, right, because if we get our elbow up, we're getting called for a penalty, I'm going to use my side delt, and I'm definitely going to use my hip. So if you watch basketball or soccer, there's a lot of hip battles where two players are in hip to hip, and they're trying to drive each other off of the ball. And I think I actually had this slide in the presentation. Right. So here's two examples, right? So we have these hip battles where we're using our hips, and on the soccer example, you see there's some good shoulder battle in there, but we're trying to create space or knock the opponent off their line using our hips and shoulders. So that's going to be part of my analysis of if I'm going to do some competitive grapple drills, right? And again, using the general term, what are the weapons I'm allowed to use? Well, if in soccer and in basketball, my hips and shoulders are my main weapons, I'm going to create exercises where I'm going to put athletes shoulder to shoulder or hip to hip, and we're going to try to push and either create space or brace and resist pushing and resist force to hold space, because that's a key aspect of our on-field positioning. So it could be as something as I'm going to put our two soccer athletes there. We're going to put a line between them, right? So we'll envision they both start in a neutral position. There's a line between them. And on the coach's command, we're going to do a shoulder battle only, pushing through our shoulders for, I don't know, 5-6 seconds. And at the end of the whistle, whichever side of the line we're on, that's the winner. And so we create a little competitive game, and we do it like, okay, now we're going to do the same setup. But we're only going to use the hip. So no shoulder, just hip. So we're going to have to learn to push and create forces through the hip. Going back to that conceptual learning, now I start the kinesthetic sense of feeling pressures on my hip. I'm feeling when my opponent has over pressure, and maybe I can step back and slip them and they're going to fall down. Or when they're putting under pressure and I can quick squeeze in and take the space from them. Or I feel when their hip is above mine and I have the leverage advantage and I can uproot them, or their hip is above under me and I need to reshape and resync that hip to get back to a strong position. I don't know if you can learn that in any other way than experience, I know the coach may be able to see, oh, their hip was under you, but the only way to correct it for the athlete is to feel it and adjust. So we need to create those learning environments. So are we going to do all sorts of, battle for over and under hooks and body locks and pick up our opponent like we would with a football rugby athlete? Maybe for fun, but the overwhelming majority of my exercises are going to be focused on what are the applicable weapons to the sport. Can I generate and brace forces through those key areas? And sometimes we're going to do activities where the goal is to create movement, because that's important on the field. And sometimes we're going to do activities where the goal is to resist movement. So I'm learning to brace and hold position. And we're just going to integrate those things in and around our programs, especially late stage prior to going into preseason camp, when they're going to have to do these battles on a regular basis. And I had a really great story talking with a strength coach who was working with some national development level women's soccer players on doing these exercises. And just the psychology and their comfort was huge. And they were like, I've always struggled in this area. But now I'm kind of I'm feeling stronger. I'm feeling more confident. I'm learning about how to actually do it. And that helped her so much. And I think that's a huge aspect around this style of training.
Definitely. And I think from that, like you mentioned, the kinesthetic awareness point of view, I'm just looking at Ronaldo on here, and you've obviously got the hip battle going on, and you're figuring out, okay, where do I need to push? If I push off the inside of my foot versus the outside of my foot, am I going to generate more force or less force? If my hip's above the opponent, am I going to be able to leverage him well versus is my hip below the opponent? And I think it's that understanding that's the real education. And to be honest, I think that's where you get the real transfer, because no matter how many slide board shuffles you do, or no matter kind of hide and bounds you do, that is not the same as what you're seeing on the soccer field.
No, not at all. And I love what you say, because I think that's, to me, what we've called, and I've mentioned, conceptual learning. If I don't understand what happens when I lose the hip height battle or when I've won the hip height battle, well, my expression of force is going to be completely different. So my best move might be to reshape and reposition my hip before I try to exert force, because I want to get to that quality position. And so how do you learn that? How do you get good at it? The conceptual understanding of us talking about it is also completely different than applying it against an opponent on the field. And so, you don't just talk through your skills, you actually go out and practice them. So we can talk through the importance of winning the hip height battle or winning the shoulder in front battle to slow the opponent down and shield the ball. But I have to be able to do it multiple times and get the feeling for it and be able to apply it. And I think I love the example here, because both players' eyes are completely glued on the ball. If we're looking at the soccer example and the basketball example, where they're relying 100% on kinesthetic sense to feel their opponent and make their next move, because they have to track a ball. And so we always talk about visual acuity and target acquisition in the visual side of sport, which is huge. But I think the kinesthetic sense of, can I feel an opponent and react to them based solely on that input, is massive. Obviously, probably more important for, say, a line player in football and basketball player, or a line player in football than maybe a guard in basketball. But everyone has to have it in some point. For me, the programming becomes how much exposure do they need based on how prevalent is it in their sport.
Mm-hmm. And I think as well, that helps with the buy-in as well. If you're explaining to the kids, look, this is how this is going to carry over. Look at this picture of Ronaldo here, holding his shape kind of. And then obviously what I used to love personally when I was an athlete was we'd maybe do some sort of wrestling, grappling drill. And then we go and actually play a game and where we've got to enforce it for 5 minutes. And then we come back to the drill. And it's that to and fro, which depending on how your coach operates and things can be quite hard to do. And you just can't do that sort of stuff, obviously, in the weight room. You can't do your RDLs and then go onto the rugby field and back in. It's understanding that transfer and saying, okay, this is our position. We're maybe going to do kind of the hip drill that you talked about, where we're just doing a lateral push, focusing on putting force through the hip. Okay, and then we're going to go and actually, how does that look when we're replicating what Ronaldo's doing here? We're trying to keep the ball off the opponent while putting force through the hip and winning that hip battle. And then hopefully if you're doing it from that isolated to kind of integrated approach, I think that's going to work a lot better.
Yeah, I'm a big, and I know people have different philosophies. I'm a big whole part whole coach. I know some people are part whole, but yeah, I love the idea of we're going to play some sort of situation, right? We're going to see who responds well, who has a good grasp of the skill. Maybe then we're going to do this lateral. So for soccer, I'd say I'm going to play a game in a very small space where I know physical contact is probably going to happen because we're limited in our ability to play in free space. I'm going to increase the amount of contact that happens in the sport, the amount of earth in the game, the amount of shielding that's needed. Then I may go to some one-on-one line push games and activities. So they start to feel their hip, feel their shoulder, understand what we're trying to accomplish. Then we're going to go back to the game. And hopefully that kind of test retest model, the light bulb is going to go off for one of those athletes and be like, oh, hey, I get it. When I do get my hip underneath, life is pretty good. Like I should do this more often. And so, yeah, huge fan of that work. And then like all things, I mean, you're working in the biz, you know what it's like. Traditional squats and sprints don't always go over well with athletes, right? I'm on the tennis team, not the track team. Why are we running so much? Like, okay, you're always having to sell why this is important, how it's going to make you better, and the why behind it. And so I think the whys are pretty outstanding and very understandable. If we would just take the time to try to say, all right, you know, here's why this is important. Here's how this is gonna benefit you. And plus, when you do these can just be fun. I mean, let's be honest, they can break the monotony. A lot of our athletes have a good competitive spirit, team bonding culture, a good laugh. There's all sorts of stuff that happens out of this stuff. And we could call this a contact drill, a grappling drill, a push-pull drill, which we might not think of for soccer and basketball, but at the end of the day, really valuable learning stimulus and can be great changes of pace, great additions, and I think help athletes learn how to take their increased maximum output into a more sport-specific situation instead of just relying on sport practice. Let's prepare them as much as we can. I know the guys at Elon have some great stuff where I believe it's their soccer players where they're doing some lateral push, and they've even started to use it with to help train lateral shuffling. So instead of like rigging a band and doing lateral shuffles versus a band, they're doing kind of manual resistance lateral shuffling, where the pressure's through the hips and the shoulder and they're leaning on each other, but they're really learning to drive off that opposite leg, push through the force, generate more force. So the other thing I tell coaches all the time is the best coaches find a way to hide it and get it in, like in a manner that their players enjoy. And while that's an art and a science all itself, and I think that when we can hide it in there, we're like, it's awesome. So sometimes you put these in part of your warmups, like as a late stage warmup, you do all your locomotion kind of general warmup. And then we're going to do a shoulder battle or a hip battle as part of a late stage warmup, get the mind switched on, get the nervous system switched on. And now we're ready to go have a good practice. I mean, any way we can sneak it in and make it fun is awesome.
100%. And I think like you pretty much nailed it there in terms of, like over the last few years in particular, being in the industry, like the job of a strength conditioning coach, well, number one, you're a stress management coach. You've got to obviously understand the different stresses. But I think as well, it's you're a salesman. You've got to be able to sell your drills to the coaches and to the athletes while keeping it fun. And then one of the goals I've had in particular this last year is I want the athletes leaving my warm-ups. So I get 15 minutes at the start of every session to take their warm-up. And there's always some sort of goal in mind, whether it's kind of a speed day or change direction or whatever it might be. Maybe we've got some recovery-focused stuff at the start there with some mobility. But I want them leaving that session or that mini kind of micro-dosed session of speed smiling. That's my number one goal, because if they're leaving it, every time they come back to me otherwise, they're going to be like, oh, it's like the fit, as they call it in tennis, it's the fitness guy. Like, it's that stigma that's attached with that of, oh, we're going to have to work hard or whatever we're doing is going to suck. And then I hopefully manage to change a bit of that stigma in terms of, oh, Chris, can we play a game today? Like, oh, what game have you got for us? Like, can we use the balls? Can we? We had a game called like Chase the Snitch and stuff like that they loved. And I think by using and hiding your S&C, whether it's through crawling patterns and things like that, is huge. And then I think a good example of how we, like, essentially I stole some of your ideas and how we introduced it into the warm-ups was we finished off with a weight room session earlier in the semester, and it was just like a 20-minute session after post-practice. And coach comes over to me, he's like, oh, like, Chris, is that enough? Have we really done enough? And I'm like, yeah, but you're forgetting the 20 minutes, the 25 minutes we had in the warm-up. Like, that warm-up wasn't just the warm-up. It was a lot of kind of isolated strength development through crawling patterns, and we also did some speed work and things like that as well. And it's how you can hide it into the whole system that makes a huge difference for the outcome of the athlete at the end of the day.
I'd say one thing, and I tell sport coaches this all the time, because I tend to work back and forth across boundaries just because my studies were in kind of the S&C stuff, but I operated mostly as a sport coach, is that sport coaches, I believe, can learn so much from S&C coaches about the sales aspect. And we'll use the stereotype, but you all know it. Most of our college athletes came to college to play their sport. So not all of them love the training process around their sport. Everyone's got an image of a particular athlete in their head right now. So I've found S&C coaches have a tendency to have to sell a bit more, like, this is going to make you a better football player. This is going to make you a better soccer player. Here's why we're doing this. And there's some unique communication strategies and tools that they have that oftentimes the sport coach hasn't had to use because, well, they came to play the sport. So they're like maybe a little more invested in the sport. But when there are those tough moments of having to sell the why, I mean, I've learned more from S&C coaches on how to handle that aspect. And I think generally, they have a better framework on that stuff. And, you know, you look at, I don't know, something like Conscious Coaching or The Language of Coaching, kind of two books coming out from S&C that, you know, they're publishing a lot more stuff on how to manage those processes, whereas I haven't seen many sport coaches publishing books on that communication aspect and how to handle that process, probably because it's just less of a challenge. But if I can add to my toolbox, man, it's a great resource for sport coaches to learn about that aspect of your guys' job. It's one that I'm huge on.
For sure. Because I think strength and conditioning coaches go into the meeting or like working with the athletes knowing that the athletes are not there to become a weightlifter or whatever that is. You know, it's they're there to play the sport. So we know we've got to sell the product a little bit more.
We all have, there's one or two that love the training.
Yep.
And for everyone that loves the training, there's one that the training is just filling the time till I can get back to sport. And then there's, you know, a bell curve somewhere in the middle. So yeah, we're definitely dealing with that.
100%. Now, just moving on, I don't want to keep too much more of your time because I know you're busy. But now, I don't know if it's a stupid question or not, but I was told no question is a stupid question. So I'm going to go with it anyway. If you were limited on time, and I know there's so many different variables involved in kind of what your sport is and things like that, and what essentially physiological outcome you're looking to get from what you're using, the implement you're using. If you're limited on time, what would you be your go-to exercise?
Oh, man.
Now, I know it's a very broad, I've just thrown the net out there. It's huge.
So off the top of my head, I would probably say a hybrid exercise that I really like, which would be a crawl to a tumble to run. So if I'm thinking I'd sneak it in my warm-up, right, as a way to manage the time, I would start with a crawl pattern, right? So we're going to say we're going to crab walk. I'm going to crab walk, then I'm going to reverse shoulder roll. So I'm going to get some tumbling, some great spatial awareness. It's going to be a very, 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 very micro dose, but we're going to have to hit the ground. We're going to have to deal with the forces of going to the ground. We're going to learn to tumble and dissipate those forces. And then I would, out of the roll, probably get up and accelerate through the line. So I'm working on variable start acceleration with a contact as I hit the ground and a crawling pattern. So I'm thinking that would be the most I could cover with one thing incredibly quickly. And then I could do bear crawl into shoulder roll into sprint. I could do, you know, lateral bear crawl into log roll into shuffle. But I, if I was really limited on time, maybe I wouldn't get the body to body contact, but I could get a little callusing and a little dealing with force and impact through hitting the deck. I know people hate burpees, but when programmed well, having athletes go to the ground in various manners gives them the tools and the comfort to manage that on a game day. So I'm not going to say just go do burpees, but tumbling, crawling, things to manage interactions with the ground, incredibly important for sport and injury prevention. I do like a little oof, like you hit the ground, you build a little callus, your shoulder has to contract, the forces are coming different, you're tumbling through them. And then I could also sneak acceleration out in the back end of it, and it's always going to be a variable start as they scramble to the feet. So that, and I just came up with that off the top of my head, so maybe later today I'll come up with a better answer, but if I was really limited on time, I think I could sneak three things in one and do it late stage warm up. And if we did it every day as a micro dose, you know, I could get some positive benefits of players learning to control themselves in space. Plus obviously crawling is just good because it's crawling and we develop a lot through that exercise.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. And then the, I suppose in terms of microdosing each session, if you've got, like you say, 5-7 minutes, being able to squeeze this stuff in, and maybe the focus is going into team practice, they're looking at coming out of, I don't know, like a lateral change of direction or whatever. You can obviously put, like you say, you put the cherry on top of the warm-up in terms of you're coming out of that roll off of the ground into that lateral change of direction. And I think that's very important to obviously bridge that gap to practice, but more importantly, with your football players, rugby players, even soccer and basketball athletes that are going to have to hit the ground at some point. Like, they need to know what it feels like to hit the ground, take a tumble. My tennis players, maybe not so much. They stay away from the ground as much as possible. But even if they're on a clay court and sliding, they're going to take a tumble every now and again. So it is important to be able to absorb those forces. Like, we do all the eccentric work if you want, but if you don't know how to stop, drop, and roll for the best part, then you're going to probably struggle.
The thing I love about that as well, right, is, athletes are going to go to the ground. And so gravity is not kind to 6'10" players on the basketball court, and gravity is generally not kind to 300 pounders. So it's like, I think those athletes need quite a bit of it that can be useful. And then to your point on the integrated warm-up, as far as understanding practice, I've offered this advice to many a strength and conditioning coach who is worried about their sport coaches, maybe adoption or buy-in, is that late stage grappling stuff. So maybe I'm going to do some shoulder battle drills with our football athletes. I'm going to do some pummeling or a body lock game with our athletes in late stage. If like typical in American football, Tuesday is going to be your heavy collision day, your heavy work day, farthest away from the game. So like on a Tuesday warm-up, I'm going to do the last drill of my warm-up is I'm probably going to do all my movement stuff. Then I'm going to do a crawling activity. And then I'm going to do a grappling activity because they're about to go punch around for an hour and a half or 2 hours, right? I want to make sure the shoulders, traps, upper body, neck, core are switched on for what's about to come. So yeah, I'm a huge fan in putting some of this in the late stage warm-up so that our athletes are warming those particular skills up. It's part microdosing, but it's also, like I said, if we're going to go from warm up to competitive period, I want to make sure that not just my running mechanics and lateral shuffle, backpedal mechanics are primed to go, but are my shoulders and upper body battle aspects primed and ready to go before we have a competitive drill on the football or the rugby field?
It is literally that fight or flight instinct. Is it ready to go?
Yeah.
That's what you're doing on the field. You're going to battle.
And it's, you know, plus it, I'll be honest, we use a lot of big romantic language, dominate to the deck, iron clamp, right? fight, height, prepare, you know, our bodies battle ready. One, it sounds cool. It helps with buy-in with the players, but also some typically our combative sport coaches enjoy that kind of language. So there's some salesmanship there.
Oh yeah. Everything, you're selling everything at the end of the day. Just finally here, are there any books that you'd suggest that would be great kind of point of interest for any coaches wanting to learn more about this stuff? Any kind of areas that you go to pick up any ideas?
Yeah, so I would say there is a new resource coming out that I don't believe is out yet. If you guys follow on Twitter, I'll give you this, but let me pull this up real quick. So Ollie Richardson, his Twitter account is at Fighter Strength. He's a well-known kind of grapple-based coach that works in rugby. He's currently back in the UK after spending some time in Australia. He has a new resource coming out. It's not available yet. I'm really excited for that because he's been hugely influential. Love his work. At USA Football, I hate to be that guy, so I gave you another one first, but our Prep for Contact manual will be coming out prior to this season, if depending on what happens here, obviously, with our current situation in isolation. It'll be mainly focused at youth and high school. The high performance variant won't come out until 2001, which would be a little more high school leading into the college, but starting to get these ideas out there. So that'll be a free resource. It's up on usafootball.com. Launch dependent, again, on everything that's going on and with COVID and everything. But we're excited about that. We've shot some videos. We've written a manual to support it. We've integrated it into all of our youth-specific practice plans. So 5 to 10 minute block of, quote, athletic development integrated into the on-field practice plan where we'd work on some of this material. So I think those are going to be great. But most of it is honestly coaching manuals. I've never found a great book, although Jeremy Frisch, who a lot of guys would know and gals would know from the social media world, great youth development coach. He has some excellent, excellent, like turn of the century PE books. And they actually have a lot of stuff. The physical culture then, you know, I'm sure you all know from like your sports degree kind of history classes, but you know, Indian clubs and gymnastics and grappling were part of the curriculum at that time. So a lot of those turn of the century, early 1900s PE books have some great stuff in there, but it's you kind of got to search around and pull it out of some of those PE curriculums. So those are where my go-tos are, is coaching manuals by the coaches that are living it, and then that early literature on kind of PE and athlete development back when these were really integrated parts of what everyone was doing.
Perfect. I'm going to give Fighter Strength a follow on Twitter and hopefully wait for that book to come out. Hopefully it comes out sooner rather than later. Just finally, just to close out here, where can people find you if they've got any questions on any of these methods and things like that? I know you are active on social media.
Yeah, my social handle on both Instagram and Twitter are USA Football MT. So USA Football, the letter M, the letter T. I'm lucky I get to do this for a living as the, again, senior manager of education and training. Coach education, coach development is my job. When you go to a clinic, everyone says, if there's anything I can ever do for you, just let me know. And a lot of people are just saying that because they're at a clinic. I get to do this. I get paid to do this to help coaches support our sports. So I will always answer a question. I'm here to help try to develop coaches. I'm not better than anyone. I just get to study this all the time because it's my job. So my email is A. Ryland, which is my last name, R-Y-L-A-N-D, at usafootball.com. Shoot me an email. Happy to set up a call. Happy to answer any questions. Anything I can do to help push our sport forward is why I do this. And so I'll always take the time.
Oh, awesome. Well, I won't keep you any longer, but thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to come on today and throw some ideas around. And to be honest, I loved it. I wish it's getting me back into wanting to play rugby, and wish I was almost working back in a contact sport. But that's been phenomenal, and I've really enjoyed it. So thanks ever so much again for coming on today.
Well, in the great American tradition, I'll call you Coach. So, Coach, hey, thanks for having that's always a fun one with all the guys from overseas. But I was following your social media yesterday, and you had put out a, hey, who would you like to see on the podcast? I saw the list of names that were coming in. It was absolute great practitioners, and I'm getting super nervous thinking, what the world am I doing on this tomorrow when you can have all these guys on? So really appreciate the opportunity to share what we're doing at USA Football, some of the work I'm trying to do with some of the colleges and universities. So it's been a thrill. I hope you guys got something out of it that you can use or steal, or maybe planted a seed that presents a great idea. So super appreciative of the opportunity.
No worries. Thank you very much. Have a good day.